The recent suicide deaths of Anthony Bourdain and Kate Spade have placed attention on the issue of suicide and what to do to prevent it. Sad fact is that suicides don't just happen after a celebrity death. Every day, lives are lost, families are torn, and the regrets that something could have been done, well, they start as well. Are there signs that are missed due to too many confused being intrusive with showing concern? With us now to discuss this issue from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is Dr. Alex Crosby. Thanks for being here today, Doctor.
You're quite welcome.
And learn more about this and to see an interesting report, which I'm also going to include on our download page on our website. You can go to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention website, which is cdc.gov. I guess the best starting point is maybe to dispel perhaps a blanket belief that might be a catalyst for missing signs. Is it fair to say not everyone who's depressed commits suicide, not everyone who commits suicide is depressed?
I would say that is true. There has been research that has looked at, you know, what they call longitudinal studies, which means they follow a group of people over a long period of time and have found that the majority of people that have clinical depression do not die as a result of suicide. They die from other things. They die from heart disease. They die from diabetes. They die from cancer, and not necessarily from suicidal behavior. And also, you will see that because of, you know, the research that has been done on suicidal behavior, it's oftentimes an interaction of multiple factors. So even though a person might have clinical depression, there may also be substance abuse. There may also be a relationship problem. There might also be financial problems. And oftentimes, it's the interaction of those multiple issues that put a person at risk for suicidal behavior.
So the point of which someone commits suicide, that's not always a hair trigger action. It could be over a significant period of time.
That is definitely possible. You do see some variability in how suicidal behavior manifests itself. There are some people that have much more, if you want to call, impulsive suicidal behavior. There's a precipitating event, and they respond to that right away. But there's many others for whom they have contemplated suicide. It's been something they've thought about, and you know, it progresses over a series of, you know, whether you talk about weeks, days, months, years even, you know, for some people. So there is a variability in how people engage in suicidal behavior and kind of the longevity of that.
So with that idea or that timeline of there's this point of thinking about it and there's the midpoint before doing it, what are some of the things people in that person's life should be looking for, listening for, watching for?
You know, there are a couple of different ways in which loved ones, family members, friends, coworkers can be looking for things that happen. When we did our study that was released last week, one of the things that we looked at were what are called precipitating circumstances for the suicidal behavior or the person that died as a result of suicide. And one of the things that was found there is that there are things like relationship problems, there are things like job problems, a crisis in the past or upcoming 2 weeks, problematic substance abuse. So sometimes those events might be the place in which, if there's someone that you're concerned about, that you engage them in a conversation. You try to get them some resources. You can maybe identify better a person's going through a divorce. That's something that you can see. Here's a concrete thing that's happening. They've got a case in court in which maybe, you know, there's a child custody thing going on. They've just been laid off from their job. You know, that kind of thing are discrete events that someone can, you know, maybe, you know, my friend might be in trouble. Maybe I need to, talk to them a little bit more. There's also some of the warning signs. Those can sometimes be a little bit more challenging for a layperson to try to identify, but there are, you know, specific warning signs that have also been looked at by, you know, organizations that look at suicidal behavior, like somebody having increased anxiety or increasing substance abuse, you know, use of alcohol. Those kind of things can also be signs that a person can look for.
So with Dr. Alex Crosby from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, cdc.gov is the website here on Issues and Ideas. Downloaded some of the info from the report, too. And if someone wants to, again, think with just the superficial and geographically, You would think states like New Jersey, New York would have high suicide rates for various reasons, crime rates, taxes, pressures, whatever the case may be, urban life, suburban life, whatever. But surprisingly, New Jersey is number 50 out of 51, the 50 states, including the District of Columbia, with the lowest suicide rates. Surprisingly, probably to most people, will be the fact that Montana has the highest suicide rates in your new report. Is there anything that could be, at least through the numbers, do the clue experts into anything?
When we have looked historically at, you know, state-by-state variation in suicide rates, it has tended to be in the past that the northeastern states tend to be at the low range in regards to, you know, what they call age-adjusted suicide rates, or you're taking into account, you know, the age distribution in the states, whereas the Rocky Mountain states have tended to be the highest states. You know, when we have done an examination of state-by-state suicide rates, those Rocky Mountain states, as you know, kind of draw a line from the Canada border all the way down to the Mexican border, always tend to be the top 10, top 13 states in the United States. And there's still a lot of theories about why those states tend to be high. You know, some of it may be, you know, access to services. You know, those states are pretty rural, and we do know that rural areas have higher suicide rates than urban areas. You know, so does it have to do with the rurality of those states, and especially with access to services? Does the person have to go, you know, 50, 100 miles to get to a behavioral health or a health facility or, you know, a primary care provider? You know, does it also have to do with some other things that might be in terms of, you know, support of services in those places too? So there's still some theories about what's going on with those states, but that's been something that's been identified for a while.
And with that idea that Dr. Crosby has mentioned too, if you're in a rural area, even in areas such as New Jersey and even Catskill area of New York comes to mind too. If the services aren't there, connections still are through the suicide prevention hotline, which is 800-273-TALK, 800-273-TALK. It's a, if nothing else, it's a starting point, and it's a voice that will listen, and they are trained experts as well, so they can at least give you those first steps for getting it all back together. One thing else, something else I noticed too in that report, Doctor, it seems like no matter what the state, the suicide rate per 100,000 among females is on a dramatic increase versus the males.
It is something that we also remarked about. It has tended to be, again, historically, that suicide rates among males are higher than among females. And when you look at the rates among males, they tend to be about three to four times higher than females. When you look at suicide attempts, you know, non-fatal, females higher than males. But when we saw that the rates among females were rising higher than males, again, it was something for us to pay attention to. You know, what are we doing in regards to prevention where we may need to refocus some of our efforts? You definitely don't forget about the males, but we may need to refocus some of our efforts on females and what's changing in regards to females that they may be at risk for suicidal behavior. So it was definitely something that we marked on and, you know, are working with our partners to try to make sure that there are adequate resources that are focused on females also that might be at risk.
Just as a reference point for New Jersey, from between 1999 and 2001 through comparing that to 2014-2016, rate per 100,000 for males went from 13 to 14.6. That's less than 1% increase. Where the female rate went from 3.2 to 4.4, that's a 2.3% increase, just to show you the wide disparity, and that's pretty much consistent through each and every state. We talked about the layperson. As far as the medical profession, obviously a psychologist, psychiatrist, they're the closest person to that person in trouble, but are there things that medical physicians should be watching, looking for, and do a connection with the family or a mental health professional?
Absolutely. Many people, and as a matter of fact, the majority of people, in terms of being taken care of for a mental illness or a mental health problem, are oftentimes seen by a primary care physician. They're oftentimes not seen by a specialist, a psychiatrist or a psychologist. So that means primary care physicians also have to be very clued in and aware of what are some of the things that they might be able to identify where they might understand that someone's at risk. it may be some of the same kind of events or circumstances that, you know, a layperson would be working for. You know, do you have a patient that might be, you know, having some relationship problems? You know, are they, you know, going through a divorce? Have you seen them, you know, are they fighting more with their, you know, with their spouse more than usual? Are they having some problems in terms of, you know, substance use? And so it may be a matter of, you know, those primary care physicians or the specialists, you know, probing a little bit more for some of the life circumstances that a person is going through to try to see, you know, is this someone that might be at risk? And one of the programs that has shown great evidence and success is something called Zero Suicide. And what that is there was a healthcare system in Michigan and has been replicated in several other places, in which they tried to make sure that there was continuity of care. If someone is seen by one physician and they got a referral to another place, they made sure that that person got followed up, that there were calls that were made, you know, not only to that person, but also, you know, to the next clinic to make sure that the person didn't get lost, you know, fall through the cracks and make sure that their care was consistent and made sure that it was followed through on.
For you listening, it's always important to understand what others are going through. And if you have a suspicion, then certainly step forward and help that person, because you can always apologize if you're wrong. If you do nothing and you are right, well, the apology isn't going to make much of a difference at that point. And if you feel yourself slipping into that darkness, then there is help. There is no shame in reaching out for help. And if nothing else, a start would be the Suicide Prevention Hotline, which is 800-273-TALK, 800-273-TALK. You do the talking, they do the listening, and together that's where the help and the rescue takes place. There are outlets, there is recovery, and there always is strength. If you don't have it, someone else is always going to be willing to help you rebuild it within yourself. Learn more about this issue and other issues of health and well-being. You can visit the website for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which is cdc.gov. We've been joined by Dr. Alex Crosby. Doctor, thanks so much for your insight into this very important issue. Hopefully it will motivate people to be more proactive instead of waiting and living with regrets that for many people will never get resolved. Thanks for being here.
You're quite welcome. Thank you for asking.